Professor Moran indicated to be probably within the minstrel tradition, whereas he differentiated that with its rather simple language from the Enuma Elish poem, the creation epic of Babylon, with its archaic and very seemingly, at any rate, literary language, a text which was used, which was chanted by the Kalu priest, as the document says, on the fourth day of the celebration of the New Year's at Babylon. Last week I had the privilege of lecturing at the University of Utah and give a paper at Santa Fe at the Rocky Mountain Modern Language Association, and also to lecture at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And there I was talking about oral literature. In fact, the general title of what I was talking about was Paths to an Understanding of Oral Traditional Epic. And the first part of my paper or talk was concerned with the way in which oral traditional singers learn and compose their poetry, and how, in other words, a tradition works. So if you'll bear with me, I don't usually like to read things, but there are just a few pages here, and I will pretend that I'm not reading them. But I would like you to get these ideas, and if I say them now, I won't have to repeat them again later. But I do think, as a first step to understanding anything about oral traditional epic, whether one is talking about its aesthetics, about its poetic references, or about interpretation of larger story patterns, of which we shall do a great deal, because it's something I enjoy indulging in. Whatever one does with this material, it is necessary first to know how a tradition works. Without knowing that, we are not justified in following story patterns back from the present, whatever that present may be, into the deeper past. We have to be sure we're working, in other words, with a traditional, with traditional material. Now, in most of the Balkan countries and elsewhere in the world, singers learn the art of telling stories in sung verse. This is oral traditional epic, of telling stories in sung verse. And you will notice that the bias of this discussion is from the point of telling a story. This is story, traditional story poetry. This doesn't necessarily mean that when I say story, I'm not downgrading it, you understand, because stories can be very serious and very important of all kinds. But it is, what I'm trying to do is to emphasize the fact that what these poets are doing is telling a story. The singers hear other singers telling stories in that way, and they begin to tell them themselves. They learn their art, not as a conscious learning of an art in capital letters, but by doing it, by telling stories. They learn by trying to tell stories in song, and by practicing doing so until they can repeat it in its entirety, one or more of the sung tales that they have heard. If they were to tell the story in prose, we would have no particular difficulty in understanding how they learn the art of storytelling, since all of us do that. all of us hear stories and try to tell some of the ones that we've heard to other people. And when we do that, we don't make any attempt to memorize the words of the story we've been told, obviously. We know how to make sentences, supposedly, and we move from the beginning of a story through its several episodes to its conclusion without memorizing a fixed text. On the other hand, we don't call that improvising either. So it is with the singers of oral traditional epic. They don't memorize a fixed text, nor do they improvise any more than we do when we retell a story we've heard. I bring this point of improvisation up because it is often thought that when we're talking about this process, we are talking about improvising, and this is not so. Actually, neither Milman Parry nor myself, so far as I know, use the word improvise for this process. It is a term which was fostered on us by the great English scholar Sir Cecil Morris Bowring. But it is not a term that we actually use. Since the storytelling is done in sung verse, as against our telling of stories in prose, they need some special techniques for rapid narration under the restrictions of verse, and over many generations of singers, such techniques have been developed. Now, notice this, over many generations of singers, the techniques have been developed. These are techniques that were not invented by one man at some time, but by a series of singers from far in the past who developed these techniques. There are many activities, things, or ideas that occur over and over again in traditional stories. And for those repeated actions and ideas, the singers have devised in the course of time ways in which to express them in the varying lengths needed for the several parts of the line. Whenever the singer needs an idea, he's absorbed from others a way of stating it under the various metrical conditions of the segments of a verse between breaks or in a whole verse. You recognize what I'm talking about. The repeated parts of lines and the repeated whole lines are the formulas that Milman Parry talked about. They're comparatively stable. They don't change a great deal. That is the central core of them. But they're not irrevocably fixed. They are subject to the changes of necessity or of what the singer may want to do as so far as meaning is concerned. In other words, to borrow a term from a present day and very fine Homeric scholar, J.B. Hainsworth at Oxford, the formulas are flexible. Very good term. Now, as an example of the Parry's definition of a formula was a word or group of words regularly used to express a given idea under given metrical conditions. And I have frequently used an example that I heard of in the field from an old singer who, and if some of you have heard this before, please forgive me, who said that you can't sing, and he used the word in Serbian for a letter, you can't sing letter to the gusla, you know, the one-stringed instrument. And if you remember, the Serbian line has 10 syllables in it, which are divided 4 and 6. And he said you can't sing letter to the gusla, and he meant you can't put a 2-syllable word into a four-syllable or a six-syllable slot. It doesn't fit. The letter happens to be two syllables, and the word in Serbian is knjiga, which means book, but it means letter in the poetry. So what he was saying was that in order to say letter in either four or six syllables, since it itself is two, you have to put something with it to make it four. So you can speak about a little letter, and there you have four syllables to put at the beginning of the line. Or you can speak of, and I don't have a four syllable, I just made this up now. I don't have a four syllable epithet to go with it, but knjiga čarovita, which means a well-written letter, fits into the six syllables. So when he said you can't sing letter to the gooselet, means simply that in order to express the essential idea of a letter within the regulations of the metrics, you had to put either a two-syllable or a four-syllable adjective with it. Once you do that, and that's the essence of the formula, because when Parry was talking about the essential idea is letter, and you express it within the given metrical conditions. Formulas and clusters of formulas particularly in couplets. Singers like to work in couplets and other combinations are aids not to memory but to composition. In the same way that grammar and its substitution systems of our regular speech are aids to us not in remembering but in composing sentences. In other words, the singer is doing within the terms of the verse exactly what you and I are doing when we're speaking. The only difference being that he is working within the confines of sung verse. Our substitution systems, by which I mean simply you have a verb ride and you can have any number of subjects to the verb ride. This is a system. It's a regular substitution system that we use in speech when we don't think about it. Nor does the singer think about his formulas, substitution systems, and so on. This is something that scholars have fun going back and trying to analyze. And we can do this with regular speech as well. In terms of the singer, each singer makes for himself a way in terms of verses of telling the most commonly occurring events or rehearsing the most important descriptions in the traditional stories. He knows how to comparison a horse or assemble an army, describe a feast or a battle, and so forth. He does it about the same way each time in about the same words, adapting the names, in other words, adjusting the description or whatever it may be to the particular song involved. Now these repeated passages are the themes of the poetry. So I've covered formulas which help in building lines. And now the themes of the poetry, which are the repeated passages. And notice, I want to stress that the theme, the compositional theme, I sometimes call it, the compositional theme is a repeated passage. It's not a repeated idea, because otherwise there is no distinction between oral literature and written literature. You can have descriptions of battles, obviously, in either oral or in written literature. But in oral literature, the poet, has a way of doing it which he uses every time he needs to do it. And I don't think normally writers repeat, whenever they want a battle, repeat the same battle, which is, however, the way of oral tradition. Using formulas and themes or repeated passages, the singer tells his tale. The non-traditional poet doesn't work in the same way as this. he carefully chooses and places his words in his own individual manner in each poem. He seeks to avoid cliches. This is the non-traditional poet. He sees his role as that of an innovator. The traditional poet has no such feeling. He uses phrases that have been used by countless singers before him, and he disposes them in the configurations of sound and parallelism developed by generations of singers. To him, the traditional phrases and passages are not only useful, but they are right and appropriate. He's not troubled by the fact that others have used them for generations, and that his fellow singers also use them. It's good to remember in regard to this that it's the story and not the style that the singer is interested in first, nor is the audience. Oral traditional song, however, and this should be noted, however, reveals a very highly developed sense of positioning of words and of word groups for sound and sense and their general balancing and configuration, thus having a very sophisticated poetics of its own, which is not generally realized, partly because people don't read very much of it, not the work of a single man, however. That this poetics, this traditional positioning of words, and that this traditional poetics is not the work of a single man, as in the case of the non-traditional poet, but it is the work of many generations. In other words, it's not that oral traditional poetry is an unsophisticated, simple, primitive peasant poetry, but rather that its sophisticated poetics is the result of generations of singers rather than of a single man working. One is sometimes asked whether traditional singers think about their songs when they are alone and work on them. This is a loaded question because it's intended to elicit the idea that oral poets do the same thing that non-traditional poets do. If they think about their songs in between performances and work on them, then obviously they're going to work on them. The questioner usually intends that they're going to work on them just the way in which the non-traditional poet works on his poetry. Yes, they practice and they think about their songs in between. However, the implication that they think about them in exactly the same way that the non-traditional poet thinks about them is false. What do they think about when they think about their poetry and practice it and work on it? Two things particularly. First, they try to remember the story. They try to get the story set down in their mind, because that's the first thing. They're going to tell a story. They are not concerned primarily with figuring out a poetics, because they have an inherited tradition of poetics already. They don't have to worry about that. That is built into what the whole art that they've learned. So the first thing that they are concerned with when they are thinking about their poems and practicing them is what's the story about, and the second thing, they simply practice telling it so that they have they do what they would do in performance, just as almost any performer practices beforehand what he's going to say or what he's going to do. And so they get the story in their mind and practice telling it. Since formulas and themes, and I'll be through with this in just a second and we'll go on to each. Since formulas and themes are a compositional necessity for the oral traditional poet, in the regions I know at any rate, and I think this is true generally, who works in rapid performance, it's not surprising that formulas and themes are characteristic and distinctive markers of an oral traditional narrative style, at least in those regions. If one observes the flexibility, the complexities of their configuration and use in poems not known to be oral, not known whether they're oral or not, one can safely conclude that they are oral. And here we're getting into another subject. And that is the whole question about the testing of what is oral and what is not, and this applies to the application of the so-called theory, or more than theory, being applied to other works, such as the work of Hesiod or of Homer, or the medieval works. The Sibylcoetian songs have been used, the Sibylcoetian tradition has been used to tell us something about these characteristics of oral traditional poetry. And some scholars have objected to the recurring the techniques and the processes found in the Balkans of the present day to some of the great poems of the past, of the ancient past, or of the medieval past. I think that to some extent they have missed the point. We were not concerned with comparing in quality the Sibylcoetian poetry with the Homeric poetry, although at its best it holds up very well indeed. What we were concerned with was a technique. We were concerned with finding out how a tradition works, what its characteristics are, and so on. So that those characteristics in general terms can be seen in other works. So when we turn to the Greek poetry, to the poetry of ancient Greece, to Hesiod and to Homer, and we look at the Sibylcoetian material for a model of how the songs are composed, we should not be put off by what may seem to be rather inferior little songs in the Sibylcoetian material. No matter how inferior those songs may seem to you, they represent a poetics which is intricate and sophisticated, and which I could explain that sophistication in greater detail. The problem is that very few people look at that sophistication. They look at the sophistication of Homer and then read the stories in Sibylcoetian translation, and my translation leaves much to be desired, and they don't bother about the sophisticated poetics of the Sibylcoetian material. So I want to stress the fact that what we were concerned with the Sibylcoetian material was the knowledge about the processes of composition, and not with any intent of saying that this was Homer. But they're doing the same thing that Homer did. And to say also in their behalf that one finds the same traditional in story patterns in the Serbian, and I should emphasize this, that one finds in the ancient Greek and in other important traditional poetries. Now to turn to ancient Greece and to Hesiod before we come to Homer. There's no particular need to prove that there was a tradition of song poetry in ancient Greece. We have some of it. It's too bad we don't have a great deal more. But we're very fortunate that we have both Homer and Hesiod. Probably Hesiod is the older of the two, and it may well be. This has been argued, of course. And the latest editor of the Theogony of Hesiod accepts this, that Hesiod is probably older than Homer, and the Theogony is probably the earliest recorded Greek poem. And the editor I was just speaking of is M.L. West of Oxford. Theogony. It's got an extraordinarily good introductory section and the Greek text. It doesn't have a translation, but it's got reams of commentary afterwards. That's very useful, the commentary. And it is not only the latest, but the best edition of the Greek text. I mention it, however, particularly for the introduction and commentary, in case you want to look at it. Hesiod probably lived between, and this poem was probably written down, perhaps he dictated it to somebody, between 730 and 700 BC. This poetry then, this and Homer, which comes just a little after that, it really is of no particular importance whether Homer came first or Hesiod came first. It no longer is. It used to be. And it used to be because people thought that Hesiod borrowed the terminology, borrowed phrases and so on from Homer. But if one realizes that they're both traditional poets, you no longer are concerned with one borrowing from the other because they're using the same hexameter language. Homer and Hesiod use the same techniques and they use the same language. And this language is more comparable to the language, let us say, of Gilgamesh than it would be, let us say, to the language of Enuma Elish. So Hesiod falls, and this poem falls somewhere between 730 and 700. Probably the best guess, and not a bad one. Hesiod, when he dictated it, probably had a particular occasion in mind. The scholars have thought this from some of the words, some of the implications in the introduction to the poem, and I'll come to that in just a minute. However, Hesiod was, although he may have, this may be something that was written down and sort of tailored for a particular occasion, he was nevertheless a regular singer. Whether he was a professional singer or not, in other words, whether he got paid for it or not, I don't think really matters. But he was a singer of traditional stories. If we turn to the idea of the Theogony, by its no great surprise to you now to say that theogonic poetry or stories about the gods and how things began was a very well-known and common enough kind of traditional poetry in the ancient Near East. You've had considerable of it already. It was also common in Greece. And we at least know the names, with which I will not bore you, of other people to whom theogonies were attributed. So this was a perfectly regular traditional genre in ancient Greece as it was in other places. And we know enough about some of the other theogonies to know that they were not the same as Hesiod's. The theogony begins, you remember, with the invocations to the muses. You've had nothing really of this sort in the other traditions in the ancient Near East. And I think it's fascinating to watch the differences between the Greek material and the material you have been reading up to now. You don't have this invocation of the muses to tell you, to inspire you to song, to the best of my memory at any rate, in the other traditions, whether they be theogonies or epics of war or whatever. So here is a difference. And you notice also when you come to talk about the introductions to the theogony that there are three of them, not simply one. There are three invocations to the muses. The first one begins, "From the Heliconian muses, let us begin to sing, who hold the great and holy mount of Helicon, and dance on soft feet about the deep blue spring and the altar of the almighty son of Kronos. And when they have washed their tender bodies in Permessus, or in the horse's spring or Almaeus, make their fair lovely dances upon highest Helicon, and move with vigorous feet." I don't think any of the material so far which you have read of oral traditional tradition in the Near East has begun in such a graceful way. "Thence they arise and go abroad at night, veiled in thick mist, and utter their song with lovely voice." And then they begin to say, having spoken to the muses, they begin to say what they sing about. "Praising Zeus and Hera and Athene and Phoebus Apollo and Artemis and Aphrodite and Hebe and Dione and Leto and Iapetus and Kronos, Eos, who is dawn, Helios, who is the sun, Selene, the moon, Earth too, and great Oceanus, and dark night, and the holy race of all the other gods." And why did I go through that? Because you notice the order, you start with the muses, and then the next thing is Zeus, and then you go back from Zeus to earth and heaven. So that first proemium or introduction, you're giving a list of what the contents are, as it were, goes from Zeus back to the beginning of things, to earth and starry heaven. Then it centers, after this little catalog, it centers on Hesiod and on singers. And a very famous passage, "The muses said to him, shepherds of the wilderness, wretched things of shame, bare bellies, we know how to speak many false things as though they were true, and we know when we will to utter true things. And so the ready-voiced daughters of great Zeus plucked and gave me a rod, a shoot of sturdy olive, a marvelous thing, and breathed into me a divine voice." And so Hesiod is speaking of his own inspiration from the muses. In other words, this is a sort of guarantee of the truthfulness of what he is telling, because although one can tell false things, one can also tell true things. And the implication here is that it's all true. And that's the first introduction. The second introduction, and clearly it's a new beginning, in comes, Come Thou, let us begin with the Muses who gladden the great spirit of their father, Zeus, in Olympus. And they, uttering their immortal voice, celebrating in song, first of all, the reverend race of gods from the beginning, those whom earth and wide heaven begot, and the gods sprung of these, and then next they sing of Zeus. In other words, the second introduction goes in the opposite direction from earth and heaven to Zeus, and it even goes beyond that. And again they chant the race of men and strong giants and gladden the heart of Zeus. So they go beyond Zeus to the generations of men and even include the giants. And this is a longer introduction because it goes on to tell more about the Muses and gives names of them and so on. And it is also famous indeed for what it says about princes, about kings. And this is where the implication comes that Hesiod was singing this on an occasion for a king. And we knew that at one time he took part in some competitions, and the winner of those competitions was a king. I believe it was Amphidamas. And it is thought that these praises of kings and king, the relationship of kings to the Muses, is a reflection of the fact that Hesiod is singing this song to Amphidamas and his family. And it is therefore a tribute to the man and the family to whom he's singing. And then finally, this second introduction speaks about the effect of song on people. For though a man have sorrow and grief in his newly troubled soul, and live in dread because his heart is distressed, yet when a singer, the servant of the Muses, chants the glorious deeds of men of old and the blessed gods who inhabit Olympus, notice these two differentiations, the glorious deeds of men of old, the Iliad and the Odyssey, and the gods who dwell on Olympus, Theogony. At once he forgets his heaviness, and so on. And the third, and probably the shortest of the introductions, sings of grant lovely songs, celebrate the holy race of the deathless gods. We've had that phrase repeated three times, who are forever those that were born of earth and starry heaven and gloomy night, and then the briny sea. There are changes in this, but it just doesn't go on to Zeus, but goes on then to the main part of the story, and one begins with the creation, and one goes back to the very beginning. Now, what does the beginning look like, and what is the technique that Hesiod uses in going at this, the telling of this particular story? Well, it's a little different from just any other story. And what it is a annotated genealogical catalog. He gives a series of genealogies and stops from time to time to comment on the significance of who is who and so on. So that in its form, it is a series of genealogies. And it is amazing to me, always has been, how Hesiod manages to keep all of these genealogies straight, because he follows them. He follows them very carefully, and I've got it all written out as to where things come, because I've traced it out. And he keeps these genealogies. I know some people are very good at keeping all their aunts and uncles and cousins and so on to the 15th remove well in their mind. And so it is with Hesiod. And this work is in fact, to some extent, so given to the genealogical approach that he may forget about some other things in order to keep the line of the genealogy. When he says that earth and heaven had 12 children, these are the Titans, then you can check it off. He will tell of the marriage of each one of those 12. They're all there, and their offspring, and so on. So it's a very carefully worked out. It may seem at time to be confusing, but Hesiod is not confused by the situation, and he is following the genealogical catalog. And this is a very important for the traditional singer. The traditional singer has to have a sort of frame, a system, a way of organizing his material. And the catalog frame is very common in many transformations in oral traditional style. So it is this, and behind that, or in front of it if you wish, there is running the myth, so that beyond the and associated with, I think we'll put it in front, associated with the genealogy is the basic myth of the theogony, which is a succession myth. And a very significant form, one of the best forms we have of the succession myth. Of course, you've seen the succession myth before in Enuma Elish. This is a succession myth as to who the great god is going to be. It's a hymn to Zeus, but it shows the succession of the kingdoms in heaven before Zeus, leading up to Zeus. And one of the striking things, I think, which differentiates this from the others that you've been reading, is that it is thought of in terms not only of human psychology, but also in terms of human reproduction. I don't think before we've had as much sex. In fact, there's been very little sex in the other material from the ancient Near East. But it blossoms out with Hesiod in an unforgettable way, because earth and heaven are not only thought of in anthropomorphic terms, but what should one say, incomplete anthropomorphic terms. That is, they are creatures of parts. They have sexual members, so that earth creates sky. Without sex, something has to start it. And then sky and earth lie with one another. So that the whole system of theogony here is really thought of in terms of human reproduction, and in terms of human psychology, because Uranos, heaven, hates his sons. He's afraid of them. And the sons hate their father. And I suppose in psychology, this is supposed to be the way things are. It's not always that way, thank heavens. But it is said that Uranos hated particularly the last of his sons, and that the sons were disturbed about their father and hated him. Particularly did the last of his sons, Cronos. And this is true of the next generation when we come to it as well, that there is the tension between generations which is purely human. And this is of considerable importance in motivating. Notice the difference. In Enuma Elish, the way the sky and the earth are separated and the universe is formed is by the cutting of Tiamat into two. You have a monster. And here, the way in which earth and sky are separated is by a completely human plot of the son and the mother against the father, and Mother Earth providing Kronos with a sickle with which he castrates his father and thus separates. That's the separation of heaven and earth. And sort of in terms of marvelous anthropomorphic terms of heaven and earth having intercourse, and at that moment the son, who is still inside, it would seem, castrates his father and separates the two. Now there's a little element there, and I'll finish. There's a little element there which is, which I found rather interesting and strange. And that is that it is said that the reason that they're angry at their father, and the reason that Earth is angry at heaven, and Kronos too, who seems to be rather precocious about these things, is that heaven first devised shameful things. I think that's a pretty good translation from the Greek. But you see, some sort of judgment has entered here concerning sexual intercourse. That it was heaven who devised shameful things. Now, if you look back to Gilgamesh and to Enkidu and the harlot, there is no, so far as I remember, there is no judgment passed on the actions involved there. If anything, they are considered to be very beneficial. Whereas here, as in Genesis, you have the idea of the devising of shameful things. And I found that a very interesting note here in the Theogony. Well, I think I better stop now, and I will go on Thursday.